Hello and welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast, your weekly dose of talking about watching soccer on TV, online and apps. Coming up on episode 62, we discuss our thoughts on Fox's World Cup TV schedule, why German soccer fans hate Mondays, how Turner Sports is trying to hire a basketball star for their Champions League coverage, as well as the latest news about new soccer documentaries coming our way. Plus, we have letters from you, the listeners, in our mailbag section. My name is Christopher Harris, a.k.a. The Gaffer, and I'm joined today by Kartik Krishnaya. For people who haven't listened to the podcast before, what we do is take a deep dive into the soccer media landscape. So we talk about everything from commentators, TV rights, streaming, the best way to watch the sport, a lot of topics that are not covered by anyone else. So rather than just talk about the football, which we do from time to time, we definitely focus on how to watch it and how to make it as easy as possible to watch the beautiful game. So Kartik, let me have you start off with what you've been watching this past week.
Yeah, and I'll admit I didn't watch a whole lot of football. Probably less football than I've watched any weekend where there's been major European club matches in years, largely because of the school shooting, which took place about 2 miles from me. Or 2 to 3 miles from me at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, had a number of vigils, had a number of memorial services, town meeting type events to attend or to watch. And in addition to that, just didn't feel like watching a whole lot of football, related to that, right? I mean, it's just been a difficult weekend emotionally, a difficult week emotionally for everyone in my neck of the woods. But I did watch the Wolfsburg-Bayern game, and it was just so typical of so many Bundesliga games the last few seasons where the opposition to Bayern jumps out to a lead. They have chances to extend that lead. They don't take them, and Bayern beats them at the end. It was just very, very typical of those sorts of matches that we've seen.
And also also typical of Robin winning a penalty.
Yeah, yeah, right. Whether Arjen Robin has historically, you go back and forth on him, right? Is he winning a penalty because he's great with that move he has to his left foot, which fools defenders, or is he winning a penalty also because he likes to dive and feign injury? Mm-hmm. He not only dives. The thing that bothers me about Arjen Robben and has for years is there are players who dive, and we talk about divers. Robben will dive and feign injury, and because he's been an injury-prone player, he didn't do that in this instance, but I'm just now you've given me an opportunity to jump on my soapbox. It makes it so much more believable to sell a call because he's been an injury-prone player. So that's something that will always mar Arjen Robben's brilliance for me, unfortunately, as a player.
It's he's almost taken it to an art form. You know what I mean, it's not just the dive; it's just the theatrics of it. And you feel for him. You're like, oh my gosh, he looks injured. He looks really bad. Maybe that's the end of his career. And up he pops, and Lewandowski, converts a penalty, and Bayern wins. I mean, it's the same story all over again.
Right, and it's something that the officials in the Bundesliga seem to have fallen for time and time again. And officials at the international level. I mean, he did this for the Dutch, most famously, I think, in that 2010 World Cup run under Bert van Marwijk, where they got to the final and lost to Spain. But he was play acting the entire tournament. Well, actually, 2014 against Mexico also. Yep. So it's just a recurring pattern, and officials have bought it. So watch that game. But I spent this weekend watching documentaries. So I went. So when I say I didn't watch football, I meant live football, live European club football. The Netflix documentary on Juventus, First Team, as it's called, was released Friday evening here in the United States. So I binged on that this weekend, watched the whole series. I liked it. But in terms of watching it, here's some advice if you're a hardcore football fan. Episode one is like a remedial course on why European football is so big, why it matters, what Serie A is, what Juventus is, how big Juventus is. Clearly episode one was designed for the American sporting audience. The narrator of the series is American, and the terminology is all American. In fact, at one point, Juventus was called a franchise, which just made me cringe. Okay. But it was all just kind of these Americanisms to paint the picture for a largely American audience why Juventus is a big deal. Okay, if you're a football fan of any kind, you know Juventus is a big deal. You didn't really need episode one. But the rest of the series, there were only three parts, but two and three were outstanding. Probably better than the documentaries we've seen about West Ham, Watford, etc. on NBC, the Goalhanger films productions by Gary Lineker, maybe slightly better than those. Definitely better than the Liverpool fly on the wall series, being Liverpool, that was screened on Fox Sports here in the U.S. About 5 years ago now. I think more than 5 years ago, actually. I think that was 2012. So it was good. It's worthwhile. But my advice is to skip through episode one or just fast forward through it, get certain parts so you're into the mode, so then you can binge on two and three back-to-back consecutively. A lot of Gigi Buffon versus Wojciech Szczesny-type talk in episodes two and three. That makes sense. It's been a big underlying theme of Juventus this season, as Szczesny has pushed Buffon, the legend, in terms of that number one shirt. So I enjoyed it. But again, episodes two and three. I also spent the weekend, once again, binging, because we have some new episodes now, or newer episodes, I should say, on the Salford City documentary, going back to the very first episode, which is from the summer of 2014 and early fall, when the five class of 92 legends, basically everybody but David Beckham. David Beckham has bigger ambitions as far as the club.
And for listeners who don't know, it's the club that's on the suburbs of Manchester in Salford. That's owned by, co-owned by Scholes, Giggs, the Neville brothers, and I think that's it, right?
Or Nicky Butt.
Oh yeah, yeah. Always forget about Nicky Butt.
So the five of them obviously co-owned the club. They co-owned 100% of the club when the series started, but then the Neville brothers obviously knew Peter Lim, who they then sold half the club to, and you know, subsequently, both Neville brothers worked for Peter Lim's other club, Valencia, much bigger club, obviously. Salford City, by the way, one interesting angle about it that we forget from the media world is, so Phil and Gary Neville are both at the club. They're both it's funny. They're the first ever game under this ownership was against Bury. I was disappointed the documentary didn't mention the reason they were able to schedule Bury in a friendly was because the club secretary for Bury is actually Gary Phil Neville's mother. That wasn't mentioned. But otherwise, the documentary is so good, so fantastic. And it kind of reinforces to you a couple of things. How difficult it is to run a lower division team in England. And then for someone like me who has been around the lower divisions in the United States, how still more opportunity and easy it is to attract fans at the lower division level in England, or interest, because you have promotion and relegation, and how there's still more money flowing into those lower divisions and the amateur levels or semi-professional levels, because they do pay some players in England. So the point I was going to make about the media, the BBC moved to Salford very controversially a few years ago from London, and you had a bunch of BBC journalists saying, hey, they don't want to move to the north. There's this north-south voice in England, for those of you who aren't familiar with it. What was interesting is Phil Neville is a Match of the Day pundit at the time when the documentary starts, when they buy the club. Gary Neville, of course, is on Sky. So they're both trying to attend as much Salford City matches and have as many meetings with club personnel as they can, but Gary has got this long commute to London he has to make for Sky constantly in the first few months of this of their ownership of Salford City. Phil, also a media pundit, just has to go around the corner. It's really reinforces to you the paradox of that, and now how different it is for the culture of the BBC actually being at Salford versus the Sky in London. So that was a neat thing from a media angle, but I highly recommend the documentaries. They're on Netflix.
So both the Juventus documentary and the Salford City documentary, both on Netflix. The one question, right, Kartik, I have about the Juventus documentary is, I've added it to my list, so I'm definitely going to watch it, but how current is it?
It runs through they didn't have a winter break this year in Serie A, but it runs generally through that, through like the end of December, early January. So it's pretty current, but they're in an epic title race, right?
Yep.
And I hope, I don't know what the what Netflix's plans are. Are they going to make subsequent documentaries taking us through the rest of the season? They're in a neck and neck race with Napoli. And they did such a good job in this documentary of playing up the north-south divide, which also exists in Italy. It's reversed, right? The north is like the south in England, right? The north of Italy and the south of Italy is like the north in England. But they played it up with the Lazio and Napoli matches. They talked about the bees. They talked about Torino. They talked about the stakes of having won all these Scudettos in a row. They talk about the importance of Europe to Juventus and how that is what Allegri and the season is going to be judged on. It would be so inconclusive if they don't have the two-leg tie against Spurs. They don't have the title fight with Napoli, which at this point we have to believe is going to go down to the wire. It was so well done, episodes 2 and 3 in particular, as I said. Really enjoyable to watch. One of the best football documentaries, a fly-on-the-wall type documentaries that I've seen. But if it leaves off in the middle of the season, it from a historical context, a few years from now, we're just going to look back on it and say, that was a waste.
Now, speaking of documentaries, Kartik, one fascinating documentary that's just continuing to unravel is the one with Manchester City, which is going to be on Amazon. And Manchester City and Amazon's filming the entire season, the 2017-18 season. And the Wigan-Man City game, I'm sure, is going to be on there. There's going to be some interesting footage on that one, I hope.
Yeah, obviously Pep, behavior at halftime was questionable going into the dressing room after Fabian Delph got sent off for what I thought was a clear red card offense. Although, again, the referee, I think that the anger about this from Man City fans in defense of them is that the referee pulled out a yellow first and then switched to red. But I think most people would agree it was a clear red card challenge. Won't have Delph now for the next three matches domestically for Manchester City, which are Arsenal in the Cup Final, League Cup Final, which is on ESPN for us in the United States, Arsenal in the Premier League, and then Chelsea in the Premier League. Wrong time to get suspended, obviously, if you're Fabian Delph, a player who's worked so hard to become a first-choice selection. Guardiola now is going to find himself out of the team and maybe for three matches at least, and maybe longer term than that, because I don't think Guardiola loved what he did. Now, moving on, there at the end of the match, Fox, they didn't focus on this because I guess, again, they don't put a whole lot of effort into broadcasting the FA Cup. And in addition, in defense of Fox, the FA Cup is not like the Premier League. You don't find things out right away. There are not as many television cameras. There aren't as many angles. Although this was a Monday night game, so I think maybe there was more. They might have gotten word of it sooner, but no discussion really at the end of the match of the implications of the pitch invasion. Now, there was a pitch invasion, which I think is very natural when you beat a bigger side and you're a lower division side, which. And also keep in mind there's a geographic closeness between Wigan and Manchester. Wigan is in Greater Manchester. Now, maybe Wigan supporters should expect to beat Manchester City the way that they've been. They've now eliminated them from three of the last six FA Cups, which is a great statistic. And I'll tell you, as a Manchester City supporter, when Wigan was in the Premier League, even though Manchester City generally beat them, the games were much more labored and difficult than they had been than they were against similar opposition. In the Premier League, generally Manchester City would need late goals to win or wear Wigan down. And there have been games where, particularly under Roberto Martinez, where Wigan controlled possession and had better chances early. So it's a bit of a bogey team, but still a bigger team. So they beat them. They get excited. I don't know what Kun Aguero is doing. I think it is very disappointing that the media in Britain and some of the pundits who cover the Premier League in the United States just have decided, you know what, the player is within his rights to do this to a fan. I think the player should have been suspended and suspended for a long time because pitch invasions are a natural part of football. I don't know why a player who makes multi-million pounds, hundreds of thousands of pounds a week, actually in Aguero's case, he's allowed to react to a fan saying something very natural obscenity. You could say it's player safety because they're on the pitch, and okay, so maybe Wiggins, Marshall's need to police things better. But I don't like a player being able to act violently towards a fan who's celebrating a great victory, and it's just acting in the emotion, saying something that I think very naturally supporters say to opposing players.
But Kartik, we don't know what he said exactly. I mean, it looked like there was definitely contact before that. I mean, kind of whether it's been pushing. I mean, my thing is that this is more of a civil matter. This is more of a police matter than an FA matter. Yes, I agree that Aguero shouldn't have done that, but that's so hard to regulate. I'm sure the referee didn't see it either.
Yeah, I'm sure about that. And again, I guess maybe it's a player, it's a Wigan safety issue at their pitch. But Aguero, you're a professional. You just need to walk away. You don't need to get charged up in the emotion of the moment. Now, in terms of the implications of this result, well, Wigan once again has eliminated Manchester City. Wigan once again is going on a long cup run, which has hurt them in the past. They got relegated the year they won the FA Cup. They did not get promoted back to the Premier League the year they got to the semifinal of the FA Cup the following year when they should have won that semifinal match. Federici, who was their goalkeeper, made a horrible error against Arsenal in the semifinal. And so it went to penalty kicks and they lost, if I remember correctly. But they didn't get promoted, and they kind of ran out of gas in the playoff. And then now they're pushing for promotion. They're in League One now. Having been in the championship last year and been relegated, pushing for promotion back. And I just hope this cup run doesn't take too much away from them. I'd like to see them back in the championship. They're going to face Southampton next, a club that might be suffering from this cup run, as they have not been able to replicate their FA Cup form in the league. So then Champions League midweek had Chelsea versus Barca on. It was a game which I thought Chelsea did some very, very nice things. Were able to open Barcelona up on the counter. Unfortunately, that mistake by Christensen led to Messi getting a goal and a 1-1 draw. But once again, Chelsea gets a result against Barcelona. I believe that's 8 straight meetings between the clubs where Barcelona has not won. Now, there was obviously the 2009 controversial Hendrik Overboo semifinal in the Champions League, but Chelsea didn't lose either leg of that semifinal. They were both draws. Barcelona went through on away goals. In this tie, though, I guess the thing that was so refreshing to see is that Chelsea, who has been in a funk, came out of that funk, played some very nice, attractive football, were able, even when they were on the back foot, to counter quickly in this formation, which has been much maligned by Conte, where he doesn't play with Morata or Giroud, but he plays with Hazard as a number 9 and goes with both Pedro and Willian on the wings. Next is Manchester United, who we saw on Wednesday. Jose Mourinho got achieved his goal, a 0-0 draw, which is what he's going to try and do against Chelsea also. There was absolutely no effort to play football by Man United. And it was quite frankly difficult to watch. I watched this in my office and actually took the computer out by the television in the conference room to watch this match and regretted doing it. What was interesting to me, and this is a worthy topic of discussion, Chris, in general, Fox, they seem to be putting more effort into actually covering and analyzing the Champions League. Whether you like the way they're covering it or not, that's a subject for another time. But more resources and more thought from their analysts, from their studio analysts like Alexi Lalas, and from their co-commentators like Tony Meola and Stu Holden, and then the commentators, obviously, and JP at Del Camera and John Strong, than they have in years. Maybe the first few years they had the rights, they put a lot of effort into it. And that was when I think they still had Christian Miles hosting, right? And it was Eric Winalda as the studio analyst. And Bobby McMahon may have still been around, right, at Fox in those days. So this is the most effort they've actually, their personnel, Fox personnel itself, on-air personalities have put into covering the Champions League in the 9 years, or since the first couple years of the 9 years that they've shown this property. Yet, it's as the property is departing and moving to Turner Sports, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. How do you explain that?
I don't see it, Kartik. I'm watching every Champions League, well, not every Champions League game, but almost every Champions League game, but all the pre-game. But to me, it's decent. It's not fantastic. I always walk away thinking, okay, what did I learn from this? Was there some insight or observations or something tactical or anything of substance? And I always walk away with nothing. It's always interesting what they're talking about in terms of just even talking about, Paul Pogba not starting and talking about that for a few minutes, but I'm not walking away with any. Now it's better than it used to be, but I'm still not impressed. I don't know. That's me. And again, the listeners might disagree and might think that it's good coverage. I think for the most part, most people are tuning out. Most people aren't watching the pre-match.
Oh, I don't think it's good coverage at all. Yeah, I don't want to confuse people here. I don't think it's good coverage at all. I think I'm almost positive Turner will do better. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But it is better than Fox. Look, I think last year on this show, Chris, I said I don't even bother to watch Champions League on Fox, right? I'll turn on at 2:45 if I'm going to watch the match, and I'll turn off right at full time. These last two match days – oh, no, it's not two match days. It's really one match day, right? The first legs of the round of 16 – I've gotten some interesting nuggets out of Lawless, not much out of Barton. Okay, Barton is still very limited in his ability to analyze things. Gotten some interesting nuggets out of Lawless, and I think the effort has been there from Miola and Holden. John Strong is always good, but the effort has been there from Miola and Holden to understand and analyze the matches in a way that maybe there hasn't been for Fox personnel when they've done these type of matches before. Now, that having been said, there's still a lot missing. I would completely agree with that. There's still a lot missing. And this Grant Wall segment now, and it's not Grant Wall's fault. He's just responding to the market or where the market's gone. This Grant Wall segment has become a transfer gossip talk in the middle of February. The transfer window is closed. But unfortunately, this is the way soccer media, it's not about Grant Wall, it's not about Fox. This is the way, Chris, the entire soccer landscape, soccer media is going, football media in Europe as well, where you open a football website in the middle of February and it's all about transfer stories. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't really want that on the Champions League pregame show, to be honest with you.
Well, it doesn't have to be that way, though, Kartik. If Fox and Grant, and I'm not sure how much Grant drives the narrative or the stories, or if it's Fox telling Grant what to report on. But they don't have to go the transfer route. But that's the thing at the end of the day, is that's where the eyeballs are. That's where the interest is. That's where people will listen in rather than tune out. So I guess we'll have to wait and see. Fox would have to wait and see and look at the numbers for the pre-match and say, okay, well, are numbers up or down? But it's so hard to tell because there's so many different variables and it depends who's playing that day. It's challenging. But to me, I would expect Fox to look at some other stories and not Major League Soccer, not U.S. soccer, but stories from around the world that are particular to that. But it's difficult. The easy route is go transfer stories and talk about Pogba rumors and Alexis Sanchez rumors and things like that.
Lacazette's another one they've brought up, right? Yeah.
I would say though too that I've been listening to Stuart Holden more in his analysis when he's commentating games. I haven't had a chance to listen to JP and Tony Mueller as much just because they've been doing the secondary games. And I've had that on, but I'm usually listening more intently to the FS1 games. With Stuart Holden, it's interesting. I think I don't know if this is on purpose or if this is just by him looking up to Taylor Twellman, but he seems to be kind of a style is very imitating a lot of Taylor Twellman's style. So I don't know if that's, again, just rubbing off from listening to him a lot or not. But that's what I picked up on this week, was just that he's getting more comfortable. He's getting better. And I think the comfort level is between John Strong and Stuart Holden. I think they're a good team together. But Stuart Holden, to me, reminds me of Taylor Twellman. For example, free kicks. When a free kick happens, Stuart Holden's predicting what's going to happen. He's like, okay, you know, Lukaku's going to take this kick. I think he's going to kick it towards the top corner and let's see what happens. And of course, the ball hits the wall. But those are the types of things that Taylor Twellman's very, very renowned for, is kind of calling the play ahead of time. And when it comes off, he looks great. When it doesn't, not so much. But yeah, it's... I don't know. We'll have to wait and see what Turner does. I mean, maybe Fox's coverage is better than what Turner will be, but we'll have to wait and see. Now, Kartik, for you, I know you kind of jumped into documentaries this past week a lot. For me, I escaped from all the Parkland shooting incidents and kind of tragedy and stories really by watching probably more football this weekend than I've ever done probably this whole entire year. It started on Saturday with the FA Cup. I watched Sheffield Wednesday against Swansea in a full-blooded FA Cup encounter. I watched Eibar against Barcelona, Huddersfield against Manchester United. And here we go again with VAR. I mean, the commentator. The thing with VAR, I think, that I found out now, just from watching the last few months of VAR intently, is it's the commentators that the ones that are creating the confusion. There's less confusion on the field, it seems, but the commentators are the ones that they're getting us confused. For example, in this Huddersfield Man United game with the Juan Mata offside call, it was Gary Taphouse, the commentator, that said, yeah, that was onside. There's no that's definitely a clear goal. There's no way that the referees can overturn this one. And then it goes to VAR, and the VAR says, okay, he was offside. So to me, the confusion, I mean... Again, this could be partly communication. There needs to be better communication between the referees, whether they're mic'd up or whether it's the VAR crew with the commentators. But that's what I've found this past few months, is it's the commentators that are causing the confusion, getting us all upset, and then we go and look at to see what happened. In this one, I mean, we can talk for an hour about this one. I thought it was interesting. Actually, it was a good thing that Fox had Dr. Joe on. He came on and his analysis was that it was a few millimeters or maybe 1 millimeter offside. Now, that didn't end the debate at all. And of course, there's the squiggly lines from the VAR crew in England that caused more confusion. But ultimately, was it the correct decision or not? Marginally, yes, but if you're going to go down to that degree of, a margin of error, where there's no margin of error, I think it's I don't like it. I'd rather it be. I think the rules need to be changed. Really, if whether there's needs to be space between the two players, but when it comes down to millimeters, probably it's 50-50. VAR's not going to get it right all the time, and they're probably going to get it wrong a part of the time too. But anyway, I think the commentators are partly to blame in this one in terms of creating the confusion. I did watch Genoa against Inter Milan. Watched actually more Serie A this weekend than I've seen in a long time. I also watched Napoli against SPAL, and I think that was on the Sunday morning. And this, to me, is a perfect example of how Serie A is struggling from TV viewership. And this game I watched, you got Napoli, top of the table in Serie A, playing in front of a stadium with a track around it, a huge bowl. Anyone that's watched Napoli at home knows this. But then also all the empty seats, all you see is empty seats around the entire stadium. And from a TV viewing perspective, it's a complete turnoff. There's no atmosphere. And what had happened, I think, on the Sunday was that it had rained a lot. So the people from the bottom part of the bowl, kind of the bottom seats, and moved to the top. So from a TV perspective, it's just a horrible view. You just see, empty seats. And that's the thing, too. I think part of the issue that with Serie A is the stadiums. I mean, without any shadow of a doubt, they need to upgrade these stadiums so they have better stadiums that have the fans closer to the pitch. And that's something too. So after watching Napoli against SPAL, I watched Augsburg against Stuttgart from the Bundesliga. And what a change it was. It was instantly, what a difference. So I went from the empty seats and lack of atmosphere at Napoli,
Just the extremes in terms of supporter culture in Europe, though, right? In major European leagues, it's going from Italy to Germany in general.
Yeah, it shouldn't be that much of a difference, though, but it is. And so the Augsburg game, a loud atmosphere, all the seats were filled, the fans are closer to the pitch, there's better TV production, more close-ups, and also the VAR in Bundesliga. I've come to the realization that the VAR in Bundesliga, while not perfect, is the best one out there right now. It's handled more professionally. There's a lot more communication on screen graphics where you see the crew in the VAR studio and you've got the video review graphic on the screen. So you know what's happening. With the FA and the League Cup, it's been, okay, are they going to VAR? What's happening? It's a lot of confusion there. But anyway, Augsburg against Stuttgart, really enjoyed watching that match. Then on a Sunday, I watched Rochdale against Spurs. Dan O'Hagan and Efan Okoku on the commentating, and a great game, actually. I was surprised by this one. But rather than let the viewers savor the post-match atmosphere from the stadium, like NBC does or ESPN does, where you've got a few minutes of the fans celebrating and the players congratulating each other and just the emotions. Within 1 second after that final whistle, Fox cuts to their in-house studio analyst, which is probably Warren Barton and Stu Holden, to get their analysis of it. I don't want to hear their analysis of it. I want to see and feel and experience the atmosphere at the stadium. Yeah, that's just me. Watched Mönchengladbach against Dortmund. The only really kind of revelation on this one was that, it's not really a revelation, but only observation was that Thorgan Hazard is not Eden Hazard by any means. Then Kartik, I watched the best match of the entire weekend, in my opinion. I loved this one. This was Real Betis against Real Madrid. Oh my gosh, I think I found my La Liga team. This Real Betis team, even though they lost, I think it was 4-2.
5-3.
5-3. Oh my God. That's right. It was 8 goals. That's right. But they play such a beautiful brand of football. It's really pleasant to watch. And I think Sid Lowe at halftime, I think Real Betis were up 2-0 or something like that. Sid Lowe said that they'll probably go on to lose this game 4-2 or something like that. But they're just a joy to watch. Good entertaining football, end-to-end action. And Real Madrid coming back.
You know what they remind me of, Real Betis? And I watched a little bit of this match, and I've seen them bits and pieces. Actually, I've seen a fair amount of them this season. They remind me of Swansea the year Swansea came into the Premier League.
Yeah. And, whether it's Rodgers or Ian Laudrup. Just a really, a team that you can really feel good about watching. Even if they lose, they're playing a good brand of football. Fantastic game. Now, Monday, this is one of the most interesting games I've seen in a long time. And this was the one I watched instead of watching the Wigan-Man City FA Cup game. And that was Eintracht Frankfurt against RB Leipzig. This one was the first match, I'm not sure if it's the first match ever, but one of the first matches in the Bundesliga to be played on a Monday, which if you watch the Premier League or you watch La Liga, Serie A, Ligue 1, you go down the list. I mean, Monday games are just a matter of fact. It's just another game.
That doesn't mean we like them, but yeah, it's just become a matter of reality in those leagues.
Now, the Bundesliga, it's a different story. There was huge protests. I mean, there were banners. There were the first 5 minutes of the game was delayed. Not only were there banners, but the fans emptied out of the standing section and stood all the way along the touchline, unfurling this massive banner that went from almost one side of the pitch to the other. There were jeers, boos, and whistles for almost the entire 90 minutes. And that's not even the start of it. So at the beginning of the second half, they must have thrown about 1,000 tennis balls on the pitch. They had streamers. They really tried to shut this game down, if not shut it down, but at least make a huge statement. And they did. So I don't know if the Bundesliga are going to keep on playing Monday games, but based on this, I mean, the fan reaction to this was incredible. I just don't see it happening in the Bundesliga.
So a couple points on this. One, Eintracht supporters are particularly intense, right? They have if you talk to people who know German football, they'll say Eintracht have, beyond the really huge clubs, right? Bayern, Borussia Dortmund, and Schalke, those three, have probably the most intense group of large, most intense large group of supporters. I mean, some Pauli clubs like that we think about, but they're not as big. So that's one. Two, the German league, for better or worse, and I hear a lot of snickers from people I talk to who are around the, quote, business of football about how the German league, they'll never progress because supporters have too much influence. Community, or this community-oriented moniker of clubs is too built into German football, the German football mentality. As someone who ears towards kind of that direction and would like to see something like that here in the United States, and in fact had a great conversation with Robert Palmer, the owner of the Jacksonville Armada, last week, and the Bundesliga is his model in his mind for so much of how clubs he feels should be run. I have a lot of sentiment for it, but yeah, it does hold the Bundesliga back from a business perspective. But if you're a supporter of one of these clubs, you know, can you blame them? Look, we saw last season when RB Leipzig, which is an anomaly in German football, right, in terms of their ownership structure, made it to the Premier League, the kind of protest that you saw from Borussia Dortmund fans, among others. It is a league where the supporters and community still control – not only control the narrative in the media, but still control a significant amount of the purse strings, unlike in any other league, major league in Europe. So that's, I think that's kind of refreshing, but will it hold the Bundesliga back as a television product, as a commercial property? Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt it's already doing that.
The funny thing about this match, though, Kartik, was that it started at 2:30 Eastern time on Monday. I was planning on watching the Wigan-Man City game at 2:45 Eastern time. But watching the first 5 or 10 minutes of this game, I was hooked. This was one of the best first halves, most entertaining first halves I've seen in such a long time. I mean, a very physical game, lots of goals. I mean, and all of the incidents happening off the pitch with the fans protesting. I just could not turn it off and ended up watching the entire game and said, I mean, just forget about the Wigan-Man City
really
game.
It kind of helped that they had that are entertaining. And I think in the case of Eintracht, it's a team that I've enjoyed watching. I think Kovac, their manager, has just imparted a style of football that is creative and open and entertaining, but at the same time is feisty and physical. I don't know how to explain that, but that's the way Frankfurt has played all season.
Yeah, and both teams fighting for Champions League spots too, so it's very, very competitive. I really enjoyed that one. Now, I went from that one, of course, I watched the Champions League matches. I won't go into those in any detail, but I went from that one on Monday to watching on Tuesday, I think it was, the Colorado against Toronto FC CONCACAF Champions League game, the first game involving Major League Soccer teams in that competition. And this one was streamed on Go90. We'll get into that a little bit. But what a contrast, though. I could only watch really a few minutes of this game. It was a really hard watch. There's no atmosphere in the stadium. It was minus 13 degrees. And I mean, I don't blame there being much atmosphere in the stadium. I mean, who would want to go out to watch a game like that in those conditions? So many empty seats. The commentators were poor. And with that temperature, the football wasn't that good.
It was actually remarkable, though, Chris, sorry to cut you off, that there were as many fans. It's the observation that many people have made since, that there were as many fans as there were, 2,600 or something. And a lot of them were Toronto fans.
Really? I did not know that. Yeah, it was just, I mean, after about maybe 5 minutes, I was like, okay, this is unwatchable. And I just moved on. But that's true. I'm surprised there were that many fans watching it. But that's the thing, though, too. TV viewership, well, it's not on TV, but streaming viewership, you know what I mean, it's not the best. I don't know. To me, CONCACAF Champions League does not excite me at all. Maybe this season will be a little bit different. I'll give it a chance. I'll give it another chance too, definitely. But it is what it is for now.
Yeah, I think it'll only emerge as a television property when a club from someplace other than Mexico wins it, right?
Yeah, or at least an entertaining final. You mean a Chivas against Toronto FC final? That's, you mean, I mean that's watchable, and I mean even if Chivas wins on penalty kicks in the final or something like that, so something that's really gonna maybe it's not Toronto FC, maybe it's, I don't know. That's the thing. I mean, Colorado's not even a good that good of a team.
Yeah, well, here's part of the problem, because the MLS plays on a different calendar. So the teams that qualified for the Champions League from MLS are the teams that were good. It's based on qualification. Now, the Canadian representative is different because they come from the neutral-like Canadian championship that winds down before the start of this Champions League season. But the MLS representatives, or I should say the U.S. representatives, the four teams from the United States that are in CONCACAF Champions League, are based on the previous year. So Colorado was in and Dallas are in based on 2016 performances. Now, Toronto was based in on winning the Canadian Cup in 2017. So they're an exception, or the Canadian teams in MLS are exceptions. It's again, a problem of calendar, but Major League Soccer has generally not had their strongest teams in the CONCACAF Champions League. This year will be an exception, and next season will be an exception because of Toronto qualifying, assuming Toronto wins the Canadian Cup, qualifying based on that. But for the U.S.-based teams, this is part of why it's been difficult. Look, I'm not trying to stand up too much for MLS. You know, you can't say with some people, you can't say anything critical of MLS. Then you're there's some sort of subversive. Yeah. Or if with conversely with another set of people in the United States, if you say one thing defending MLS and defending why MLS's results aren't quite what it is, or why the level of play may not be what you think it should be because of travel or because of heat, then you're a shill. I'm going to say this right now. I don't think it is fair to judge Major League Soccer on the CONCACAF Champions League, largely because of that qualification situation. And because it's a league that has in a model of enforced parity, generally the teams that are very good that qualify for CONCACAF Champions League a year and a half out aren't the best teams in the league the next season playing into that particular edition of the Champions League. So right. It may sound like a manufactured excuse, but I stick up for MLS on that because there's no reason Colorado should be in this competition. They were one of the worst teams in the league last season. So having them in is a bit embarrassing, quite frankly.
Yeah, something has to change there. And we won't go into the calendar debate right now, but that's one possible solution to this. All right, Kartik, we have a new sponsor of the World Soccer Talk podcast that I'm excited to share with you, and that's a company called Away Days, which is a small and an independent clothing brand based out of Boston. Away Days creates unique, beautifully designed soccer t-shirts. Now, one of their most intriguing products is called Mystery Kits. For $25, you pick your jersey size, and then you receive a mystery one. All of these jerseys are official club jerseys from around the world. They could be a few years old, but they are all 100% new and authentic. Away Days only features unique teams from different countries. So, for example, if you're an Arsenal supporter, you wouldn't want a Spurs jersey, but you probably wouldn't mind a Swedish club's jersey of a club that maybe you don't even know who they are, but it's just a beautifully designed shirt. Now, some customers have used this to start following teams they've never heard of before, and it helps them learn about how the game is played in other smaller countries and leagues from around the world. It's a cheap way to get some new jerseys, and it's a way to get jerseys of teams you wouldn't normally be able to get from big websites or stores. And for World Soccer Talk podcast listeners, you get a special 15% discount on the entire site. So just go to awaydaysfootball.com and enter promo code WORLDSOCCER at the checkout. Again, just go to awaydaysfootball.com, check out what they have there, they've got some great merchandise, and then enter promo code WORLDSOCCER for a 15% discount. Kartik, let's move on to TV streaming news.
Yeah, so Fox finally announced their schedule, David Neal, in a press release this week for Russia 2018. There are 38 matches on network television on Fox over the air. Unbelievable commitment from the Fox network. I have to give them props, hats off at this point. Did not expect that. 38 matches. That's about four times as many matches as we've seen four. In another publication, I wrote it up as three times, but I realize it's four times as many matches as we saw in either 2010 or 2014 on ABC over the air for a World Cup. Just fantastic commitment. The other 26 matches will all be on FS1. The good news for listeners out there, no FS2 broadcasts. It doesn't bother me because I get FS2, but I know so many people, including my office. We learned yesterday as we were trying to shuffle and get the it was on Tuesday as we were trying to shuffle and get the Bayern game on. We don't get FS2, which was kind of embarrassing considering the office I work in is a soccer-oriented office. So we had to have both TVs on FS1 for Chelsea and Real Madrid, which was a little disappointing. But so many people don't get FS2 is the point.
Yeah, it's good news, absolutely, for soccer fans in the United States. Originally, Fox, when they made the announcements back in, I think it was October, in the fall, they said that more than, I think, 50% of the games would be on Big Fox. It ends up being about 59%, actually, exactly 59% of the games will be on Big Fox. So good news there in terms of making sure that it's as accessible as possible. Couple of the observations, Kartik. So on one of the days, which I think is on one of the Sundays, June 17th, there's two major games going on that day, and that's Germany against Mexico and then Brazil against Switzerland. Now, you would imagine that these games would be on the Big Fox, but both of those games are on FS1. I did some research, and I think the reason that that is so is because of the US Open is being played that weekend, which I believe is on Fox, right, Kartik? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it is on Fox. So that's the reason why that those games, which would have been ideal for Fox, I mean, Germany against Mexico is going to be massive, will be on FS1 and as well as that Brazil-Switzerland game. Now, moving on, Turner Sports is closing in on a deal to hire Steve Nash as a soccer analyst for Turner Sports' coverage of the Champions League, which will begin in the summer in 2018 in August. Kartik, what are your thoughts on this one?
I like it, actually. Believe it or not, Steve Nash is very knowledgeable about this sport, has been a lifelong Spurs supporter. I know that's going to bother everybody who's pro-Arsenal out there. But he's obviously Canadian and a great basketball star, so he has some crossover cred. He attempted to play for Cosmos B a couple of years ago in NPSL, the New York Cosmos B team that plays in NPSL. There were contractual reasons he couldn't, but his brother was a Canadian international, very good player, Martin Nash, that I watched and commentated on a number of times, called games, actually, back in the day when he played for the Whitecaps, called the number of games involving him. So I think it's a good hire because he knows the sport, and he's been a great ambassador for this sport. He's been a guy who's helped to develop cred for soccer among mainstream sporting audiences. In his interviews, even as a basketball star, as his career wound down, he would always talk about how he had wished he had played soccer at a higher level and made some very intelligent commentary about the sport. So I think it's good. I still want to see who else Fox hires, though. Who else Turner hires to surround him. I know there's the obvious skepticism that they're an NBA-driven sports division and this is an NBA star, but I think it'll probably be okay. And I have to be honest with you, this is going to now get me in trouble with one of those two factions I mentioned a minute ago. His depth of knowledge and understanding of the sport at a global scale is better than most North American commentators who played soccer. So I think he'll probably do a better job than a lot of the former U.S. men's national team players we have seen try and commentate on European football.
Yeah, it's a smart move from Turner Sports in terms of taking someone and having him be a crossover. So taking him and saying, okay, Steve Nash is now doing Champions League soccer. Okay, basketball fans, pay attention to Steve because he's going to be talking about the game. My two concerns are, one is hoping that they don't dumb down the analysis, kind of doing a football versus football, kind of how Fox used to do it with the NFL, trying to bring in the NFL audience and having NFL people on Champions League final, I think it was. And the second thing is that even though I know Steve Nash knows soccer, is a huge soccer fan, often plays the game in charity events, comes from a family that are soccer players, and he obviously loves the game and has probably a lot of knowledge about this game. I haven't seen him on television. I haven't seen how he is giving kind of analysis, and that's something. I mean, I'll give him it all the benefit of a doubt, hoping that he can do a good job there. But I haven't seen it, so I don't know. So we'll have to wait and see on that one.
Couple comments on number one. So I would observe that, unlike the football versus football comparisons that Fox has tried to push, because Fox as a network appeals to a different type of audience than Turner. Fox football, there are very few similarities between American football and the football we love. And the audience, the demographic audiences are different also. With basketball, the audiences are more similar in terms of where they are located in the country, kind of their cultural appreciations. And the sports are more similar. In fact, I was just having a conversation last night with someone about how similar Pochettino's style of football and the way Spurs play, you know, Tottenham plays, Spurs play, is toward some of the college basketball teams we've seen through the years, and how some of the concepts are entirely similar. You can't have that comparison with American football because the game is completely different. I'd also mention Dalen Koff, who of course is a prominent prominent figure on NWSL coverage. He's a former basketball player who does commentary for ESPN and college basketball and is in their studio often, and does fine with both sports because I think both sports are similar. Unlike American football, it's completely different. The American football, and that's again, that's a Fox thing. And thankfully, Turner doesn't have any American football rights, so we're not going to have to deal with that.
All right, Kartik, let's move on to the next news item.
Yeah, as we teased in the last segment, Go 90s broadcasting the CONCACAF Champions League games in English in the United States this year, and you can have that the Go 90 app. It's not. It's not the most reliable thing, but it's free and it's accessible. So that's kind of the situation. And that tells you where the CONCACAF Champions League is as a television property after being on Fox for years.
Yeah, it's free. And actually, when I watched it the other night, I had no problems with reliability. And in the past, I mean, I think all apps have at some point. But it seems to be stable. And also, I believe the games will be on the website also, the Go90 website. And on the English side is Go90. On the Spanish side, Univision Deportes has the rights. So many of those games will be in Spanish on Univision Deportes, and some of them in UnivisionDeportes.com. Now, iGoal, which is a new streaming soccer service, has added a Apple iOS app. So now the new soccer streaming service is available on both the Android and iOS platforms and devices for your mobile phones and tablets, etc. On the both the Android and the Apple iOS app, so you can just search for iGoal. I think it comes up as iGoal Live. You can cast those games then to your television set. So that's everything from beIN Sports, Goal TV, TYC Sports, etc. So definitely check that out.
Two women's national team games were announced this week, friendlies against Mexico in April. One of the games will be on FS1. The other will be on Big Fox.
Yeah, and I tweeted something about this too, Kartik. I said, presumably it's on Big Fox because that Fox wants to use this as an opportunity to promote the men's World Cup coverage this summer, having the game on Big Fox and kind of the mostly women's soccer audience. Even just making sure that they know that the U.S. women's the U.S. men's World Cup will be on this summer, and I think Rob Stone tweeted me back saying, like, kind of inferring that you do know that Fox has the rights to the women's World Cup, and I was like, yeah, I know that, but that's not until France 2019, the summer. To me, it's just an opportunity for, yes, to promote the women's game and show women's games on Big Fox. But I'm sure Fox is thinking, okay, this is a great opportunity to remind people, okay,
what are they going to do? Because I hate to bring this up, but what are they going to do in 2019 when the U.S., look, they got away with it in 2015, but 2019, the general consensus is unless there's some serious changes or something we don't see happening, the U.S. is not going to win that World Cup. It seems like all of their women's soccer coverage is predicated entirely on the United States being the quote dominant force in women's football. So, you know, even the fact that Rob Stone responded to you that way kind of bothers me.
Yeah, I think you would hope that they learn this summer in regards with the U.S. not being in the World Cup to be more fair and impartial and provide analysis and coverage about all the other teams and all the interesting stories. But I'm sure once it becomes closer to 2019 and the Women's World Cup coming up, they'll go back into the USA mode and just rah-rah USA. And it could come back to haunt them, especially if the US doesn't make it all the way to the final. As it looks right now in terms of some of these other countries, France and England, just as two examples of countries that are progressing at a much faster pace. Now, moving on, Kartik, Sling TV has announced that they are now up to 2.2 million subscribers, making it the largest internet-based live TV service. So Sling TV continues to grow and grow. Now, over to Major League Soccer, Kartik, a couple of key hires announced this week.
Yeah, Kevin Egan will be the Atlanta United commentator for 2018, returning after doing five games last season. Alan Green, we talked about on a previous podcast, no longer with the organization. And he will partner with Dan Gargan, former player that that I covered both in MLS and in NASL. Meanwhile, Max Brados is joining LAFC in a surprise move, a return to the soccer mic for Max. We've seen him do studio programming for ESPN, but you're going to hear yes an awful lot, because LAFC is going to be pretty good also. So look forward to that. I'm excited about that personally, except the problem is if you're in Southern California, you have to pay the YouTube subscription cost to listen to Max Brados. That's obviously a subject we've talked about previously, that right. YouTube deal that LAFC signed.
Yeah. YouTube TV. In that last piece of news for this week is that Fox Sports has announced some details about some new soccer documentaries they're planning on broadcasting this summer to promote the World Cup, but also promote its soccer coverage. So the first one is called Nosa Chape, which is a film from the guys who created The Two Escobars, which is a fantastic documentary. And this story is about the Brazilian soccer club Chapecoense, the tragic 2016 plane crash in Colombia. The film is part of the official features lineup at the South by Southwest Film Festival. And it's the third documentary in Fox Sports' film series called Magnify. Now, the other piece of news is that Fox is going to be launching a new series called Phenoms, and it's going to be chronicling the journey of the next generation of hopeful World Cup stars on their quest to represent their countries this summer. So both of them sound interesting. I'll definitely watch them. The one on Nosa Chape sounds particularly interesting and probably a really sad story, but I'm sure. But yeah, something to keep an eye out for.
Yeah, worth noting, just for those listeners who may not know this, Nat Geo, who are doing the documentaries, producing the documentaries for Fox, part of the sale of assets to Disney that will be closed at some point, probably after the World Cup. But we'll see what Fox does for 2022 in terms of documentaries, because the documentary division that they were using would now be in the hands of ESPN, actually, going forward.
Moving on to TV ratings, we don't have all the numbers in yet, but of the ones that we have thus far, some poor FA Cup numbers. Huddersfield against Man United on FS2 on Saturday. It's FS2, so those numbers are usually always poor. That one had 142,000 people watching that one. And with Manchester United being one of the most watched or most popular teams, soccer teams in the United States by far, definitely on the English-speaking side, 142,000 people. Is a sad indication of kind of where the FA Cup's at and also FS2. Rochdale against Spurs on FS1 on the Sunday, that one had 268,000 viewers. So more than 100,000 viewers, more than the game on FS2. It's probably an FS2 thing, really. And then lastly, some big numbers out of Mexico, or out of Liga MX. In the United States, and we had 1.4 million people watch the Tigres against America game on February 10th, and then 1.3 million for Chivas against Santos Laguna, also on February 10th. Any thoughts on that, Kartik?
It just reinforces how poor ratings are in general for things for broadcasts on FS1 and FS2. So if you look at FA Cup matches and a corresponding Premier League match, same time slot on NBC. Now, obviously, there's some variables because of the clubs being different, but generally, that Sunday, 11 a.m. Eastern time slot has something, some high profile club. In this case, it was Spurs. There is a huge drop off, and it just doesn't apply to the Premier League in English football. If you look at sports in general, college basketball, which I follow, there's a huge drop off if a Big Ten game is on FS1 instead of being on ESPN, or a Big 12 game. It's pretty striking. The only place where Fox does well ratings wise is in American football related properties. They just struggle with everything else, which is a concern I have about the World Cup. But maybe that's something we'll talk more about as we get closer to the summer.
Yeah, and also they got some stiff competition from Telemundo too. So it's not just All right, so moving on to the listener mailbag, and we got a review on this on iTunes this week for this podcast from someone named Away Goals Matter. So this reads, this has become one of my staple soccer podcasts because it provides the coverage of the game in the US, which no one else does. The pod covers TV and streaming rights updates, a rundown of how the games are covered, as well as numerous other topics associated with watching the game. So I think it's a 5-star review from Away Goals Matter, and we appreciate the feedback. That's great stuff. If you have any questions, feedback, comments, anything you'd like us to read out on air in regards to soccer media, or a question that it's always been kind of a burning question that you've always had, you can email us at web@worldsoccertalk.com. You can tweet us at World Soccer Talk, or message us on Facebook at facebook.com/worldsoccertalk. And of course, too, on the comments section at worldsoccertalk.com. Now, Kartik, where can listeners find you on the internet if they want to read up on your latest analysis or insight?
WorldSoccerTalk.com, obviously, and KKFLA737 on Twitter. I've also been writing recently all about lower division soccer in the U.S. So if you're not interested in that, don't bother. But at SockTakes.com.
Yeah, and you can find me at World Soccer Talk. I've got a story I'm writing right now that by the time you listen to this podcast, you'll be able to find out on worldsoccertalk.com. And that's a story about the latest news about the FA Cup TV rights in the United States. And definitely an interesting turn of events is happening right now. So check that out at worldsoccertalk.com. So thank you for listening. You can get a new episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast every Thursday. Every episode is released on SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, Audioboom, and worldsoccertalk.com. If you like the show, share it with your friends on social media. And like Away Goals Matter, you can give us a review on iTunes. We'd greatly appreciate it. And Kartik, what should they do?
Enjoy your football.